Cooper? Where are you?
Bolin stood at the edge of the water as the morning tide rolled in.
Someplace safe for the moment. How is Roland?
He is stable. I must thank you. He says you saved his life after you blew him up.
He told me to go ahead and do it. He's tough. I'll give him that.
I have no love for him personally, but he is our best in South America, or was. He will be relegated to a desk now if he does not retire. Where are you? You should not have gone to the mosque without telling me. That was foolish.
I went to rescue you from Key without telling the Foreign Legion. That turned out for the best. Sorry, but even if I'd wanted to, I wasn't given the opportunity to contact you beforehand. Now, where's Ilyanov? And who the hell is he?
Bolin almost thought she had hung up before she finally spoke.
Due to recent activity, Action Direct has broken into the Foreign Legion database. If this gets back to French military intelligence, there will be...
Lady, I don't have time for political considerations, and neither do you. Spill it.
We ignored the Interpol background checks and used our own files. Then we called in favors with British and U.S. intelligence.
What did you find?
Ilyanov changed his name when he joined the Legion. This is not unusual. Over half the Legion is from Russia and the former Eastern Bloc, and applies simply as Slavs.
The short version.
His real name is Valentin Islimov. He was a rebel in Muslim Chechnya. When his activities began to include bombings in Moscow, he was forced to flee. He spent time in the Middle East before joining the Legion.
There was an African with him at the mosque. Huge. What's his story?
Babacar Babur Nindour, Senegalese. Former heroin dealer until his conversion led to Islam. He is Islamov's adjutant in the jungle warfare school.
Bolin saw an ugly trend.
And both men are involved in security at the launch facility.
Yes, as is Tuan Nguyen Ngoc, Ngoc Ngoc as he is called, a Vietnamese Muslim. Engaged in terrorist activity in Indonesia and wanted by the Australians for the murder of UN peacekeepers in Timor. Sretko Sigarit Tadic claimed to be a Serb when he joined the Legion, but he is a Bosnian Muslim. Atrache and Sahin you already knew about. The rest of the men you killed in the mosque are unimportant, for the moment, but have similar backgrounds. What is more important is that all the men I have mentioned are now AWOL from the jungle warfare camp.
Bolin's world was getting uglier by the second.
What about Marmion? He's their commanding officer. Have you investigated him?
Commandant Marmion is dead.
What? How?
He was found in his office last night, about an hour after the battle at the mosque. He was shot in the back of the head.
What did you find out at the spaceport?
Is Dr. Mohammed Khani with you?
Bolin turned back to his little camp. He had come back to Sinemary half expecting to find her kidnapped or dead. He had put her on the back of his bike with a sleeping bag, and they had driven up to the coast to an abandoned bit of beach. Bolin had grabbed a few desperately needed hours of sleep. The scientist lay in the bag, her head veiled by the masses of her dark hair.
Yeah, she's with me.
You are at her house?
No, but she's out of earshot at the moment.
Good.
What is it?
I spoke with Dr. Seth last night. Babuseth. You met him in the Space Center lounge.
I remember him, the payload engineer.
Yes. You kept thinking that somehow the launch was going to be involved in some sort of terrorist atrocity. I spent a number of hours last night consulting with him to see if we could find any kind of discrepancy and...
And you found one.
Dr. Seth is thorough. He checked everything, and then he checked his own records. He found that industrial-quality powdered cobalt had been purchased and shipped to the Space Center Satellite Division under his name, using his security codes.
Bolin's blood went cold.
I gather Dr. Seth does not recall buying any cobalt?
No, much less 2,000 kilograms of it.
Where is the cobalt now?
That is just it. It is not in the warehouse where it is supposed to be. We tracked the transaction to a South African firm. The South African distributor assures us that the metal was paid for, shipped, and sent. All perfectly legal. Action Direct is checking all stages of the transaction, but so far it seems like the distributor is telling the truth. We are acting on the assumption that the cobalt disappeared on the South American end of the deal.
You believe Foresta bought the cobalt using Dr. Seth's clearance and identification codes?
Cobalt is a metal used extensively in modern manufacturing. There is nothing suspicious about it, alone. The Space Center Manufacturing Division here in French Guiana goes through tons of it every year. The only discrepancy is that 2,000 kilograms were bought under false pretenses. If Dr. Seth had not stayed up until 4 in the morning, personally checking inventories, it could have gone unnoticed for the rest of the year.
You think Foresta did it?
The only other likely suspects are Dr. Dutron and Dr. Poulin. Both of them are native Frenchmen, both with unimpeachable security records. Dr. Seth is a Hindu and very unlikely to be lying, much less cooperating with Muslim extremists.
Foresta doesn't give off the vibe.
I am sure Dr. Mohamed Kani gave you a good vibe in bed, but it is you who are running around French Guiana claiming terrorist plots of massive proportions. You and I both know that the only use a terrorist has for cobalt is to sheath it around a nuclear weapon to make a dirty bomb. She has the background, she had the means, she has the talent, and given her past, I am assuming she has the motivation. 2,000 kilograms of cobalt were acquired illegally, and now they are missing.
Bolin accepted every word Erulan said, but his instincts told him she was wrong.
Something's missing.
Can't you Americans ever accept the fact that you might be wrong? What if I told you that last year, Dr. Mohamed Kani became a fully licensed multi-engine pilot and is currently working on her helicopter qualification?
It would make her a very able woman.
Yes, but what if I also told you she is a member of the Kourou Shooting Club and owns a .32-caliber unique target pistol? And what if I told you that after this weekend's launch, she is scheduled to fly to the United States to an aerospace conference in Washington, D.C.? The President of France will be there for his own meeting with your President.
Bolin's hand went to his pistol. The rocket scientist would not have to ram her plane into the White House. She would not even have to get near it. All that would be required was to get airborne over the D.C. area in a plane and detonate a weapon. Sheathed in cobalt, even a tactical nuke would kill most everyone in the capital in gruesome fashion.
Dr. Mohamed Kani is coming in, dead or alive. But she is not getting on a plane to the U.S. I am letting you know out of professional courtesy. And personally, I advise you to leave French Guiana. There is talk in my department of bringing you in and having you interrogated. I appreciate your efforts and that you saved my life, but I am only field coordinator, and you have pissed off all the wrong people above my pay class.
Bolin's eyes never left the sleeping woman.
You're not telling me everything.
We have gone over deployment schedules in the jungle warfare camp, particularly training missions led by Babacar. Almost all of them were teams made up of the Muslim Legionnaires. We believe they have set up a base in the jungle. We have photographed it by satellite.
Take me there.
That would be highly irregular. The jungle warfare camp is in lockdown status. I have been ordered to stand down and wait for the strike team to be sent from Paris. They will be here in 4 hours.
Tell your superiors you went to meet me. Tell them you did it under pretense to bring me in. Then we go on a detour. After that, I'll be happy to debrief your superiors on everything we have on our side.
Tell me where Dr. Mohamed Kani is. I will send a dispatch to pick her up. She will only be held. I will work with you for the remaining hours on your hunch. That is the best I can do. Then it will be beyond my hands.
Done.
Meet me at the Space Center. I have a helicopter there.
The jungle flew by in a solid green carpet beneath the Dauphine helicopter. The aircraft roared barely inches above the jungle canopy. Flights of multicolored birds burst from the treetops, and bats blasted upward in flapping black clouds in the helicopter's wake. Bolin had left Mohamed Kani back at her house, and the chopper had been hot on the pad and Erulan waiting for him at the Space Center when he arrived. Erulan's gaze flicked down to her instruments.
We should be getting close.
She followed the path a river cut through the rainforest.
How far are we from the jungle warfare camp?
About 100 kilometers. We are in the center of French Guiana. There is nothing out here but jungle. Even the Indians do not come here. There is nothing but snakes and spiders, leopards, piranha, leeches and crocodiles here. Only legionnaires would come to a place like this.
There!
Below them, a finger of creek broke off from the river and traced a path through the jungle. It opened out into a pond and a small clearing and disappeared again. At the edges of the clearing, the trees were strung with camouflage netting. Arulan slowly orbited the camp and then broke off and did a larger orbit around the jungle surrounding it. Bolin shook his head. There could be an entire regiment of Foreign Legion deep reconnaissance commandos pointing their rifles at them, and they'd never know it. Arulan seemed to read his mind.
You are the one who did not wish to wait for the strike team.
She brought the helicopter back to the clearing. The Dauphine's landing gear slid out, and Arulan set her down. Bolin slid out of the helicopter. He had not had time to pick up a full warload, nor was he going to trust any gun he hadn't fired personally. The ancient Thompson was cradled in his hands with the 50-round drum in place. He carried both of the silenced Berettas he'd taken from the mosque. His pockets were full of grenades. Arulan jumped out of the pilot's seat and scooped up a Famous assault rifle. Bolin scanned the area. He had seen a million such camps before. There was a clearing suitable for a single helicopter, a water source, and a few benches and tables hewn out of logs beneath the cover of the trees. It was a typical rest and resupply area for troops on maneuvers in friendly territory. The threshing of the rotor blades and the leaves and dirt it kicked up ruined any opportunity to pick up on sound or movement. Bolin glanced at the ground. There were many boot prints in the soft earth. All of their treads matched the legionnaire pattern he had observed in Suriname. Most of the tracks looked several days old. Bolin moved beneath the trees. It took only moments to find the bunker. Earth had been mounded over the sunken log construction so that it looked like little more than a rise in the soil of the jungle. A very wide double door of heavy, unfinished beams formed the entrance. The ground in front of it had been rolled flat by something very heavy. A padlock secured the entrance. There were no steps, but a shallow ramp ran down into the darkness, a ramp wide enough to accommodate heavy pallets. There was a generator, but Bolin did not turn it on. He took out his flashlight as he entered and played it over the interior. The bunker was a single, low, wide room. The floor was packed earth, the walls were held in place by planking, and the ceilings by beams of tree trunk hewn directly from the surrounding forest. It was a job a squad of men could easily have done with hand tools over the course of several training deployments. There were crates and boxes toward the back. Arulan descended the ramp, shining her own flashlight around the bunker. Bolin found a rifle crate for 6 weapons. 3 rifles were gone. 3 Famous assault rifles were still packaged. Several thousand rounds of .223 caliber ammunition were stacked next to the rifles in canisters, some of them opened. Bolin found a suitcase filled with Euros. A pair of French Mistral man-portable surface-to-air missile units stood in the corner. Their tripods and optical units were in place. Both launch tubes had a missile loaded and ready to go.
We were lucky no one was here to meet us.
I do not think our presence here matters anymore.
Arulan knelt in an empty corner. She traced her fingers through the dirt. Bolin came over and found the dirt was compacted and marked over a broad 6-foot by 4-foot area, as if it had borne a very heavy weight. Bolin squatted and took a bit of the dirt between his fingers. The soil of the bunker was dark and slightly moist. Bolin shone his flashlight over his fingers. Intermixed with the dark dirt were flecks of bright blue. Cobalt blue. The cobalt was no longer simply missing. It had been deployed. Bolin rose.
I have to contact my people.
Bolin stood still for a moment. The 45 caliber slugs in his submachine gun would not pierce her soft body armor. His own armor was not rated against a .223 caliber rifle bullet on its best days, and his armor had taken a severe beating over the past 72 hours.
I have orders to take you in for interrogation.
Bolin slowly turned. He kept his muzzle pointed toward the floor even as he gauged the headshot.
I'm not going.
Conflicting emotions played across the woman's face. She lowered the muzzle of her rifle.
I know. Take the helicopter. I will call for extraction. I will tell them... I will tell them you overpowered me.
Bolin nodded and left the bunker. He climbed behind the stick of the Dauphine. The rotors beat the sky and the chopper lifted off the ground. As he brought the nose of the helicopter around, his eyes flew wide. Valentin Islamov stood next to Arulan. Beside him, Babacar had set down the firing tripod of a Mistral missile system and slid into the chair. Islamov waved cheerily. Erulen pursed her perfect lips against her fingers and blew Bolin a kiss goodbye. The helicopter's rotors clawed for altitude. Treetops scraped the bottom of the fuselage and dipped the Dauphin's nose. Bolin banked desperately. The helicopter swooped forward, but not fast enough. He threw a glance backward. A smear of yellow fire trailing black smoke flew after him just above the trees. It was moving at sickening speed. The Dauphin was a commercial aircraft. It had no infrared flares or countermeasures. The executioner rammed the stick to the right, and the landing gear ripped through the treetops as the chopper banked radically. Bolin kept the throttles full, but the Dauphin was already giving him everything she had. If the missile had locked, the only advantage he had was that the range was point blank, and his helicopter could turn much harder than the missile as it accelerated to Mach 3. Bolin yanked his stick to the left and turned into the missile's path and tried to outturn it. The Dauphin screamed as it redlined beyond tolerance into a turn it had not been designed for. Bolin gritted his teeth as the helicopter spun 360 degrees in the air as something struck it. The airframe shuddered as 3 kilograms of high explosive embedded with hundreds of tungsten steel balls ripped through the tail boom like shredding paper. Bolin did not have to look back to know he no longer had a tail rotor. The helicopter was completely out of control. Dr. Mohammed Khani was not going to be terminated or even arrested. She would unknowingly do her job and make sure the upcoming launch went off perfectly. Dr. Seth was the enemy. Bolin suspected he was not the Hindu he pretended to be. Kurtzman was right. There had been no modifications to the rocket or any special re-entry vehicle. The weapon was the satellite itself, built by Dr. Seth's team. It would fall with much less accuracy than a guided rocket, but even if it missed Washington, D.C. completely, some part of the U.S. Eastern Seaboard would be turned into a radioactive wasteland. Bolin knew that he himself was about to officially die in a tragic helicopter accident while working in cooperation with Action Direct. Nothing was going to interfere with the upcoming launch. These thoughts burned across Bolin's mind in the half second it took the Dauphin's composite rotor blades to snap off against the treetops. The tailless, rotorless, burning airframe plowed down through the canopy, trailing fire into the jungle below. The camouflaged men appeared out of the rainforest like phantoms. They were armed to the teeth. The man with the sniper rifle hung back and scanned the surroundings with his optical sight. Two men with rifle grenades fixed to the muzzles of their weapons fanned out to put the area in crossfire. Islamov, Babar, and Knock Knock approached the burning wreck of the helicopter in a widely spaced crescent formation. Javanese gunmen flared out behind them. The Dauphin was burned out, blackened, and still oozing smoke.
Baba, Knock Knock.
The two legionnaires circled the hulk from opposite sides. Both men began poking in the wreckage with their bayonets. The Vietnamese quickly held up a Beretta, its grips melted by heat. Babar fished out a Thompson submachine gun with a shattered stock. The huge African straightened as he made out the blackened lump of a grenade that hadn't cooked off under one of the crumpled seats. He made rapid gestures at Knock Knock, and the two men backed away from the crash.
And?
There is no body, Commander. Though I fail to see how a man could live through such a crash. The windows are shattered. Perhaps he was thrown clear.
He is not dead until we find his body.
Babar examined the impenetrable canopy above. The helicopter had ripped a swath down to the jungle floor, but bats, eagles, and monkeys could be feasting on the American's broken body, hung up on any one of the canopy's tiers, and they would never know it.
We did not bring climbing spikes, Commander.
Knock Knock was kneeling a few feet from the wreckage.
We will not need them.
What have you found?
Knock Knock held up his hand. There were thin streaks of red on it.
Blood.
He pointed into the trees.
He went that way.
He is without food or water, and 100 kilometers from the camp. He is hurt. Perhaps we should let the jungle kill him, rather than risk the men.
Islamov nodded and jerked his head where Knock Knock had pointed.
Fan out. Find him. Assume he is armed.
Bolin was hurt. He wasn't sure how badly, but the situation was bad enough. His side was torn. Only his body armor had prevented him from being disemboweled. He was bleeding, and his stomach and chest radiated bands of pain that made it hard to breathe. His left eye was closed. The right eye was going in and out of focus. The blood pouring into it wasn't helping. The last two fingers of his left hand were broken. He checked the loads of the Beretta he'd managed to keep hold of during the crash. There were 15 rounds in the magazine, plus one in the chamber. He had a hand grenade. What he needed was a rifle. He also needed food, water, and medical attention. Bolin checked his watch. He needed to get to the space center in Kourou within the next 60 hours, or barring that, to find a phone. The jungle warfare camp was 62 miles away, through trackless jungle. He had a vague idea that there was a town 25 or 30 miles west, but his mental map of inland French Guiana was vague at best. Bolin was already parched. The executioner tore strips from the hem of his shirt and tied his broken fingers together. He watched from cover as the legionnaires began to follow his trail. He eyed the FRF-1 sniper rifle with a marksman's hunger. The legionnaires were fanning out, and already they were predicting his course. They would be expecting him to double back toward the temporary camp where there were weapons and supplies. Bolin began ghosting the legionnaires. He'd had little time since the crash. The legionnaires swiftly came to the place where he had started trying to cover his tracks. They knew Bolin had some French, so they used Arabic as their battle language to deny Bolin intelligence. There were 18 opponents. He figured at least half of them were Javanese in Legion uniform. Bolin pulled the pin from his remaining grenade. Knock Knock knelt where Bolin's blood trail stopped. He gauged the ground ahead, trying to pick up the trail again. Knock Knock suddenly looked back in alarm. Bolin lobbed his grenade.
Grenade!
Bolin leaped on top of one of the Javanese.
Oh!
The executioner's knees drove into his back. Bolin's sound-suppressed Beretta coughed twice. The man beneath him went limp. Bolin cut the straps of the man's knapsack and web gear and grabbed his rifle.
Cease fire!
Bolin was less than a shadow as he crawled backward, using a fallen log for cover. The enemy was not firing for effect. They were firing in panic. Bolin pulled the big fade back into the jungle with his prizes.
He has a rifle.
Babar stood over the Javanese soldier's body and shook his head.
He has rifle grenades. He has food and water.
Another of the Javanese stood with a pistol in his hand. His arm and shoulder were in a sling, badly torn from grenade fragments. He glared down at the body.
He has killed my brother!
Islamov fingered his rifle. Another Javanese lay dead a few feet away. But Rashid Atrichet lay dead next to him. Shrapnel had ripped out his throat and eyes. Foreign Legion deep reconnaissance commandos were not so easily replaced. No one had laid eyes on the American, and he was already down three men. Islamov calculated the situation.
I believe our friend's best option will be to kill all of us as quickly as possible before he succumbs to exhaustion.
Neither the legionnaires nor the Javanese were particularly pleased with the announcement.
Don't you see? He will stalk us like a ghost. Even now he has retreated to his next ambush point. What he must do is kill all of us, or just enough of us so that he can take one of our radios and send out a message. That is his mission. His survival will be secondary to making contact with the outside and stopping the launch.
So?
So we deny him this option. Our survival is secondary to that. Radios, everyone, here, quickly!
Knock Knock and Cigarette took off their tactical radios and dropped them at Islamov's feet. Islamov took out his own broadband radio and cell phone and dropped them.
Babar?
The Javanese had not been issued radios. They were assigned as two-man teams to each legionnaire. Cigarette gathered up Atrichet's radio and phone and dropped them in as well. Islamov smiled at the pile of communications gear on the jungle floor. He took out his pistol and flicked off the safety.
Hey, asshole! Do you know what this sound is?
That's a dead radio! It is just us, mon ami! Just us in the jungle! The way it should be! 59 hours until the launch, my friend! And 100 kilometers between you and the jungle warfare camp! You had better start running!
Holland bound his side. The Legion knapsack contained a medical kit with field dressings. The wound was deep and wide and would require dozens of stitches. Holland had used half the tube of disinfectant and bound it tightly, but he had no illusions. In the jungles of French Guiana, the wound would go septic within hours. He winced as he pulled the shredded remnants of his body armor back over his torso and smoothed the Velcro tabs shut. His stomach growled. Holland took hunger as a good sign that he wasn't bleeding internally. His hands shook as he tore into the food. Water was a concern. Holland did not doubt that Islamov had destroyed the radios his team carried. He suspected Islamov had another radio somewhere. He would have to capture the Russian to get that information out of him. Holland wasn't counting on that opportunity coming along anytime soon. He sloshed his canteen. There was about a third left. Water was the key. He had to get to the river. Knock Knock was turning out to be a superlative jungle tracker. He followed Boland's trail despite his best efforts at concealing it. The Vietnamese seemed to have an almost telepathic ability to read Boland's trail and then examine the ground ahead to predict which way he would go. Boland had been forced to choose random paths through the jungle rather than the most direct route to try to throw off Knock Knock. The sprint and sneak routine was quickly sapping his strength. Only the fear of ambush slowed the Legionnaires, and their skirmish line inexorably drove Boland before it and away from the river. He needed to make a hole in that line and slip through it. Boland considered one of the four rifle grenades in the Legion pack. It would definitely make a hole, but the moment he fired, he would announce his position to the entire hunting party, and the salvo of grenades that would come hurtling back in answer would be the end of the show. Boland could hear the enemy coming closer. He dearly wanted to stop Knock Knock. He wanted Cigarette's sniper rifle even more. With that in his hands, he could start forcing the issue. But to get close enough to take either one of them in this jungle would mean getting within spitting distance of the entire squad. Islamov was begging him to try it. The cat and mouse game would just have to go on a little longer. Boland glanced at his empty ration tin and his field dressing wrapper. He began prying at the safety ring of one of the rifle grenades. Knock Knock froze. He raised his fist and the skirmish line halted. Sahin knelt a few feet away. The wiry Turk had his bayonet out. He carefully thrust it beneath some leaves and came up with the green plastic wrapper of a field dressing. The Javanese next to him pointed excitedly and thrust his own bayonet into a shrub.
No!
The Javanese froze. He held an empty ration tin on the end of the bayonet. Bits of leaf and dirt fell away from it. A sliver of vine fiber that stretched back to the shrub pulled away as he dropped the tin. In the split-second delay, Knock Knock clearly heard the flat click of the tripped contact fuse. Sahin fell back, twisting and kicking and clutching his face. Knock Knock dropped flat as a rifle grenade launch sounded in the jungle ahead. Cigarette sagged back against a tree, his face and chest covered with blood. His sniper rifle sagged in his hands. A filthy, blood-stained ghost emerged from the jungle. Cigarette jerked and flapped against the tree as the burst tore through his chest. The ghost ran past the Bosnian sniper and ripped his weapon out of his hands without stopping. Knock Knock rose to one knee and leveled his rifle, but the ghost had already disappeared in the trees. Two of the Javanese fired rifle grenades and yellow fire lit the jungle ahead. Knock Knock burst into a run. The two Javanese leaped up and followed him. He ran a few dozen meters into the jungle and stopped. His knuckles whitened around the grip and forestock of his rifle. The blast and fragmentation of the grenades had ripped the underbrush and torn the leaf duff covering the jungle floor. Knock Knock smothered his rage as he got down on his hands and knees and began crawling in an ever-widening circle around the grenade effects to find where the trail of the American resumed. Islamov trotted up and waved him away from his tracking.
Forget it! We know he is heading for the river. We beat him there and then let him come to us.
Exhaustion forced Boland to stop. Cramps walked up and down his ribs, and he continued to reopen his wound. The legionnaires had passed him unknowingly in their sprint for the river, but obviously they did not care. He was in a legion jungle warfare area. His opponents knew the lay of the land. All they had to do was head him off. The clock was ticking, and it was a countdown. Boland examined his prize. Grenade shrapnel scored the FR-F1 rifle, but the telescopic sight appeared to be intact. He had 10 rounds in the magazine plus one in the chamber. Boland locked a rifle grenade onto the launching ring of his Famous and slung it. He hefted the FR-F1 and started walking. It was time to go force the issue. The legionnaires had made no effort to conceal their trail as they had passed him. Boland followed the boot prints on the jungle floor. He walked a few hundred yards and stopped. He lay down in the dirt and clicked out the rifle's bipod. He peered through the scope with his good eye. The massive hardwoods of the rainforest formed a cathedral ahead. It was a natural fire lane. Boland unslung his assault rifle and clicked out its bipod. He placed the rifle in a bush facing the lane of trees and began unwrapping his remaining field dressing. After carefully tying one end of the bandage around the assault rifle's trigger, he crept a few yards off to one side and put some of the bandages slack around a sapling. He reeled out the gauze until he could drop behind a fallen tree to put cover between himself and his weapon. Boland hunkered down with his sniper rifle and opened its bipod. He eased himself into his firing position and began to take up slack on the bandage. The executioner pulled until it was taut. He peered above the rim of his telescopic sight. Boland yanked the dressing. Before the grenade detonated, automatic rifles ripped into response. Swarms of bullets chewed the underbrush around the abandoned rifle. Boland put the crosshairs of his sight onto the stuttering yellow flame of muzzle blast and fired. He yanked the dressing again, and the Famous snarled off a short burst. Fire poured into the position. Tracers drew smoking lines through the trees. Boland chose the muzzle blast of another enemy rifleman and fired. Dust flew from the front of his camouflage shirt as Boland put a bullet into his chest. An answering burst shot over Boland's head. The executioner could see the man's head and shoulders through the shaking bushes as he fired. His opponent sagged on top of his weapon. Boland flicked his bolt again, but crawled quickly back through the underbrush as bullets began streaming into his true position. He got behind a rock and reeled in the Famous rifle by the field dressing. He grabbed it by the carrying handle and ran. His heels hammered into the dirt without grace or skill as he willfully stretched out his leaden limbs for speed. He ran backward and began making a long arc through the jungle. Boland ran for cover. Islamov was down to 6 men, including himself. The Javanese had been fanatical and dedicated volunteers to the cause. They were suicide troopers, ready to martyr themselves without a second thought. This did not make them particularly good soldiers, much less jungle stalkers. There were only 3 of them left. Within seconds of the ceasefire, Islamov's instincts told him the American was long out of rifle shot and on the move. The American would be out of water, running out of grenades and ammunition. He was likely running low on blood and stamina as well. He still had a vast distance to cross. He was running out of time.
Baba.
The giant Senegalese seemed to magically grow up out of his concealment like a dark tree.
Yes, Commander.
He is going wide, flanking us, flat out for the river.
Yes, but I do not think he can outrun me.
Take the remaining Javanese. Go, run him down.
You will be waiting for him at the river shore?
We will be waiting for you, Babar. Bring us this American's head.
Babar slapped his sheathed machete and smiled. He shucked his pack and gestured at the remaining Javanese. They shucked their packs as Babar broke into a run. Islamov drank from his canteen and watched Babar plunge into the jungle. The Javanese were already struggling just to keep him in sight. The giant African's stride was a thing of beauty. Islamov faded back toward the river. The executioner skidded to a halt and put his back to a tree. His opponents had swiftly found his trail. Bolin had made no attempt to conceal his headlong flight, and they had made no attempt to conceal their pursuit. The only thing they weren't doing was baying like hounds. If they were smart, they would have a flanking team down by the river by now. Bolin raised the famous rifle, clicked his last rifle grenade over the muzzle, and stepped out from behind the tree. The three men did not die for the dirt. Bolin fired quick bursts from his weapon. Bolin's rifle clacked open on a smoking empty chamber. He ejected the spent magazine and reached for a fresh one. Babar came charging out of the trees. The giant African leaped forward. He held his rifle low and smiled at Bolin over the point of his fixed bayonet. The executioner swung his rifle down to block, but exhaustion had robbed him of his speed. The plastic fixtures of their weapons clacked, but Bolin barely managed a deflection. The blade slid away from his center line and rammed into his side. Bolin was slammed backward and pinned against a tree trunk. The bayonet point caught in the woven fibers of Bolin's battered armor. The executioner's left hand wrapped around Babar's throat, but he did not have the strength to hold off the giant Senegalese. Babar put all of his weight behind his rifle and drove the bayonet home. The point punched through Bolin's armor and steel burned into his side. The knife's edge skidded along one of his ribs, and the point punched out the back of his vest. Babar grinned in savage triumph and ripped the bloody blade free for the killing thrust. Bolin's right hand came up with the silenced Beretta pistol from his belt. Catching the bullets in the face, the giant slowly toppled to the floor of the jungle. Bolin sagged forward and nearly fell on top of him. He pushed himself to his knees and painfully stripped off his defeated body armor. The wound along his ribs was long and ragged, but shallow. But it was one more wound about to go septic. He grabbed Babar's canteen. Slightly refreshed, he took Babar's medical kit and bound and rebound his wounds. His entire rib cage was wrapped like a mummy. Bolin pulled on the ragged remnants of his shirt and stripped the deadly genere of his undamaged rifle, spare magazines, and rifle grenades. He went and took the canteens from the fallen Javanese. Two were perforated and leaking, and he drank their contents before the floor of the jungle could. One was intact and half full, and he clipped it to his belt. Bolin turned toward the river and wearily began walking. Islamov and Knock Knock remained. They would be waiting for him by the river. Bolin dropped low and crept through the jungle. He ignored the wounds in his sides as he slithered from cover to cover. He inched forward toward the sound of the river and stopped when he could smell it. Bolin strained his senses for signs of the enemy. He moved forward until he could see the brown water moving swiftly. It was about 40 yards across. The jungle made a solid wall on either side of it. Bolin moved to the water's edge and waited. Waiting went to the enemy's advantage. Time was running out. The river was his only option. The enemy was waiting for him to do it. Bolin emptied his pack of all non-essentials. Swimming the river with two rifles was an ugly enough proposition. He grabbed the exposed roots of a tree and slowly lowered himself into the water. He waited among the reeds with his eyes and nose barely above the water. He took long, slow breaths to oxygenate his lungs. Bolin sank beneath the surface and kicked off. The brown water was opaque, except for the top 2 feet where the sun shone down directly upon the surface. Bolin stayed down in the deeper, darker water and let the current take him. He frog-kicked lazily, letting the river do his work for him. He ignored his lungs as they began to revolt against the lack of oxygen in his blood. He kicked on calmly until his vision began to darken and color, and then smoothly broke for the surface. Boland sucked air even as he heard the shout behind him and the thump of the grenade launcher. He sank to the bottom. A moment later, the surface of the river pulsed orange. He pushed back up and broached the surface, kicking his legs to stay afloat and firing his FAMAS back at the figure of Islamov 100 yards away by the bank. The executioner's grenade flew wide, and Islamov ducked back into the trees. The executioner began swimming for the opposite shore. The sun was setting. Beneath the multi-tiered canopy of the rainforest, the darkness of the jungle floor was already growing thick. The birds had settled into their nests for the night. Bats rose up on leathery wings to feast on the insects that were already rising in swarms and eating Bolin alive. Other predators would be rising to stalk the darkness. The jungle was mostly impenetrable by day, and there were no stars in the jungle canopy to guide at night. Bolin was fairly certain a town was somewhere to the west. He had hoped to find signs of it, or at least the next river, before the sun fell. He drank the last of his water and ate aspirins from the medical kit. The wounds in his side were hot, and he was waiting for the beginnings of fever. Bolin raised his head and sniffed the air. He was either already hallucinating, or he smelled coffee. He unshouldered his rifle and began walking toward the smell. He was fairly sure that Islamov would not try to entice him to his doom by brewing up late-night cappuccinos in the middle of the jungle. But that didn't mean the Legionnaire wasn't close and could smell it too. Soon Bolin smelled cigarettes. He could see the orange glow of a campfire through breaks in the trees. The soldier squatted outside the light of the fire and observed the campers. A black man and an Indian sat on a log in front of the fire. Beyond them, the jungle opened up onto a small strip of beach. The long, skinny canoe was dragged up on the sand. The river gleamed in the last rays of the sun beyond. Coffee brewed in a cast iron frying pan set on two hoops of metal over the fire. The Indio was expertly cleaning a fish. The Creole was cleaning lengths of wire with a rag. A double-barreled shotgun rested across his knees. Bolin eyed the ocelot and jaguar pelts stretched across homemade drying racks and knew the two men's business. The executioner stepped into the camp. The two men froze. The Creole's hands lowered an inch toward his shotgun and stopped as he saw the high-powered rifle in Bolin's hands. He cleared his throat.
Good evening. You having piranha?
The Indio's knife stayed frozen in his hand as he nodded slowly. The Creole eyed Bolin's shredded, soaked, and blood-stained clothing.
It looks like the piranha had you.
They tried. So did the Caymans. So did the Legion.
Bolin knew he played the right card as the two men sat up straighter. Poaching was good in the area, but that was because most men poaching protected animals did not want to run into foreign Legion jungle warfare patrols. Being beaten, robbed, bound, and left for the authorities was probably the best they could hope for. The Indio lowered his fish and his knife.
They operating in the area?
Bolin pointed back the way he had come.
East, on the other side of the last river.
The poachers glanced at each other and did mental calculations. They looked back at Bolin and his scope-sighted rifle.
Where's the nearest town?
Saul is nearest, about 30 kilometers upriver.
You'd better go.
The two men nodded and then froze as Bolin reached into his pocket. They leaned forward again as Bolin produced a somewhat abused and waterlogged money clip. Despite its battered state, the poachers could not help but appreciate how thick it was.
I'll pay you a lot of money to take me with you.
No problem with that. No problem at all.